Several days ago, we were stuck. My whole family. We were stuck. Two of us, who shall remain nameless, both felt entitled to sit on the left kitchen stool, and that the right side kitchen stool was not a good place to sit. Another one of us could not believe that anyone would have an argument over something like that. Two identical pieces of furniture. And she was getting increasingly annoyed. Plus, there were several piles of folded laundry that were outside certain bedroom doors that had been there for several days now, and they irked her every time she walked by certain bedrooms. And you could hear the annoyance in our voices. And you could feel the tension that was rising between us. My son is remembering this right now, too. Then another one of us said to another one of us, "Why are you so tense?" And that did not help. And then another one of us yelled at another one of us, "Why is it that you are bothering your brother so much?" And that didn't really help either. And I found myself at that moment wishing that somebody, anybody, maybe our next-door neighbor who sometimes stops in when he's out walking his dog, would just ring the doorbell and come in and rescue our family from ourselves. Rescue us from this, like, swirling pettiness that we'd gotten ourselves stuck in and that none of us could figure out how to get off of. I don't know if that's ever happened to any of you. But it strikes me that that is the human predicament in a nutshell. We all think that we're better than we probably really are at judging who has the right to the left stool and who has the right to the right stool and why it should be ours and not our brother's. And we all think that we're better than we probably really are at judging when the laundry ought to get put away. And the reality is that we are all too easily caught up, every one of us, in this swirl of increasingly losing track of what is right and true and righteous. And even if we realize what's happening to ourselves, we feel powerless to find the off-ramp. Scale it up, and you've got what happens on many of our Facebook feeds, a reflection of our divided country. We hope for leaders who will have the capacity to rise above our hooked-inness, don't we? We hope for leaders that aren't going to get all caught up in this petty stuff, and yet they so often disappoint us. Years ago, remember back when before he was president, Barack Obama said that he realized in our country that he saw not red states and blue states, but purple? Remember that? Some of us were hoping that maybe he would be the kind of leader who could rise up above the hooked-inness. That he would be able to see true wisdom, or maybe even just a glimpse of it. Unfortunately, Barack Obama is not the Messiah. I used to think that, naively, that that was the role of U.S. foreign policy. That we are a strong country and that we could be an honest broker above the international fray, that we could go into a place like, say, Israel and Palestine or Iraq or Afghanistan, and that we would be able to get rid of the bad guys because we could see so clearly who they were, and that we would be able to honestly negotiate a peace agreement with everybody else. But it turns out that the United States gets caught up in the hooked upness, just like everybody else. Scale it up, scale it down. Even if we start out unhooked, once we get involved, it's too easy to get hooked in ourselves into the messiness that we're in the middle of. Before our family moved, there was a long-standing feud between our two neighbors in our condo building. And for the longest time, I thought that I could be sufficiently unhooked from it to be able to negotiate with everybody and come to a workable agreement. But in the end, I got sucked in too. And I felt like I was as much a part of the mess as the others, and I wasn't good at rising above it. We're hooked in. We're a hooked in people. The prophet Isaiah spoke at a time that had just as much political swirl and hooked in-ness as during our own time. And at that point in history, the promised land had already divided into two kingdoms, which on this map are actually so small that you can't really even tell them apart. They're Israel and Judah. And what was really more going on in the world at that time was that there was a superpower, Assyria, which Isaiah was written over the course of a pretty long period of time. Maybe at the beginning of Isaiah, Assyria was like where the blue is, and by the end of the book of Isaiah, Assyria had taken over most of where all that purple is. They were huge. And you can see from the map that although Israel and Judah were tiny countries, they also lived on a pretty strategically located piece of land because they had access to the Mediterranean Sea. They had access into Egypt and Africa. They had access to the east. They were a point where all the trade routes were passing through. And so everybody wanted control of that piece of land, and especially Assyria. We read in Isaiah chapter 7 how the northern kingdom of Israel had formed an alliance with another tiny neighbor, Syria. And in order to, because the two of them wanted to try to fend off Assyria, and they were trying to get Judah to join them. And when the king of Judah wouldn't join their plan, then they decided that they would try to take over Judah and install a puppet governor so that the country would do as they wished. And Ahaz, the king of Judah at the time, had so lost faith in God's ability to do anything that he started making sacrifices to the gods of Assyria because they figured if they worked for Assyria, maybe they'd work for him. And it was into this mess that Isaiah was speaking. And it was a mess. Now, in the book of Isaiah, Isaiah talks for a long time to the king Ahaz, several chapters here in this general area of Isaiah 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And Isaiah says many things. But this morning I'd like to focus in on one thing that Isaiah said that's in the section that Dan and Serena read already. Let's start by reading. You can actually skip that slide. We'll talk about it later. I'd like to just read together out loud verses 1 and 2. So please join me. A shoot shall come out from the stump of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. Thank you. Isaiah had promised a ruler, a shoot from the stump of Jesse. And that ruler would be so attuned to the Spirit, so connected with the Spirit, and so shaped by what the Spirit's wisdom and understanding was, the Spirit's counsel and might, the Spirit's knowledge and fear of the Lord, that Isaiah would be unhooked from the swirl of the people around him. Isaiah promised a leader who would not get sucked into that human echo chamber. A leader whose desires and whose judgments would not be shaped by the desires and the judgments of whoever he happened to be with. We need that kind of a leader. We need that kind of a leader. Let's read verse 3 together. His delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see, or decide by what his ears hear. Isaiah promises that this leader will not come to judge by what he sees with his eyes. In other words, his human understanding won't be limited by our warped human perspective. Because we all know, not only are there many things that we can't see because they're out of our line of sight, but there's also some things that we're blind to that maybe are right in front of us, but we don't recognize, maybe because they don't fit in with what we already believe to be true, or we don't recognize because we don't know what we're looking at. The Emmanuel who is to come won't be limited by what he sees with human eyes. And nor will the Emmanuel who is to come be limited by what he hears with his ears. He won't be limited by what other people say and the inevitable distortions and gossip that comes when we make our judgments based on what we hear other people saying. This is an extraordinary claim. No human being before or since has been able to live this way. Instead, Emmanuel's delight will be in the fear of the Lord. Emmanuel's delight will be in the fear of the Lord. And the thing that's so amazing about this verse, most English translations obscure the Hebrew text. In the Hebrew, it literally says, his smelling is the fear of the Lord. His smelling is the fear of the Lord. And every language has those funny little idioms that make sense to the person who speaks the language but doesn't really make sense to other people. In this case, some people think that his smelling is in the fear of the Lord is a reference to going into the temple and smelling the incense that's burning there. His smelling is in the fear of the Lord. The Emmanuel who is to come is the kind of a leader who stands in the temple in the presence of the Lord and breathes the Spirit in. And is not guided by what he sees or by what he hears, but by breathing in the Spirit of the Lord. Oh come, Emmanuel. Stand among us as you breathe in your Spirit. Help us to catch your scent. Help us to breathe it in with you. Let's read verses 4 and 5 together. But with righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. He shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall kill the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt around his waist, and faithfulness the belt around his loins. Righteousness shall be the belt around his waist, and faithfulness shall be the belt around his loins. Depending on which commentary you read, there's a few different belts that Isaiah could be talking about. Perhaps it's the sort of belt that they used before the invention of elastic that was used to hold up a person's underwear. In that case, the belt of righteousness is what goes on first before anything else that a person would wear. And even though nobody else can see it, that belt of righteousness, that belt of faithfulness, is what is giving shape and support to all the rest that the Emmanuel is wearing, is carrying. It's not flashy. It's not obvious. Maybe you wouldn't recognize it at first, but it's there, reliably supporting everything else. Or perhaps, depending if you read another commentary, you might see that Isaiah might be talking about the belt that is on the outside of a person's clothing, on the hold, that holds the outer robes together. And it cinches the robe together. And it also, if you are a warrior, would be what you use to hang your weapons from, like maybe a dagger or a sword. Perhaps the righteousness of the Lord is something like this. It's visible. It's visibly authenticating and holding up the rest of our clothing. And it's what supports the weapons that we do battle with when we are trying to get unhooked. Either way, the Emmanuel God who has come to be with us is wearing that belt. Come, Emmanuel. We need you. We need you, the one who wears righteousness as a belt and faithfulness as a sash around your waist. Gerald Jansen suggests that this belt and this sash, and perhaps along with the in some translations it says scepter, in this one it says rod, are part of the armor of God. It's what Emmanuel wears when going into battle. And Isaiah actually talks about the armor of God in a number of places throughout Isaiah, most notably in Isaiah 59, verse 10, where it says, "He put on righteousness like a breastplate, and a helmet of salvation on his head. He put on garments of vengeance for clothing and wrapped himself in fury as in a mantle. He has covered me with a robe of righteousness." And Jansen proposes, and I think that he's right, that Paul, remember in the letter to the Ephesians, when Paul was talking about the full armor of God, that Paul was actually thinking of Isaiah 11 and 59 and a few other places in Isaiah. But there's this interesting shift that happens between Isaiah and the letter to the Ephesians. In Isaiah, it's the stump of Jesse that wears the armor of God. In Isaiah 59, it's the Lord that wears this armor. In Isaiah 11, Isaiah is talking to a wicked king, Ahaz, who has pretty much given up on God, and he's lost his hope that Judah will remain in a kingdom for much longer. In Isaiah, God acts because the people can't. The people need an Emmanuel God to come and be their warrior in battle and to wear this full armor of God and go before them. But in Ephesians, Paul is telling the church to put on the armor of God. It's the church that wears the helmet of salvation, the belt and the sash and the breastplate and all the rest. I don't think this is an accident. I don't think this is one of those things where people happen to be using the same language. Jansen suggests, and I think this makes a lot of sense to me, Paul knew what he was doing, and he was referencing Isaiah because he was deliberately wanting for the people of Ephesus to know that the battle that they were doing was the same battle that God was doing in Isaiah. When Paul says, you are not doing battle against flesh and blood, but you are doing battle against the powers and the principalities, those are the same enemies that the people, that God was fighting in Isaiah. And I wonder if, as Paul was saying those words and writing that letter, that he was trying to empower that little church in Ephesus to do battle. To do battle by giving people access to the full armor of God. Because it is true now, in this strange time of Emmanuel, who has already come and who is to come, that we have been invited to join Emmanuel in battle. And we have been invited to wear that armor. And I think that Paul was trying to help the people to understand that they weren't to do battle between parents and children. It wasn't a battle between husbands and wives, or between fighting, feuding members in a church. It wasn't a battle even between nations. Our true battle is against what Paul calls the powers and the principalities, the swirling mess of hooked-inness that we all find ourselves caught up in. And Emmanuel, the one Isaiah promised, is coming and has come and is already here. And that Emmanuel, God with us, is fundamentally not hooked in to the swirling mass that we get stuck in. So whether it's sibling fights over who sits in what stool, or whether it's painful divisions in the church, or wars between nations, Emmanuel, God with us, has led us into battle. Emmanuel, who delights in leading by catching the scent of the Spirit, is leading us with righteousness and faithfulness. Put on your belts, sisters, brothers. Put on your belts. Emmanuel is coming. Emmanuel is with us. O come, thou rod of Jesse, free thine own from Satan's tyranny. From depths of hell thy people save, and give them victory o'er the grave. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. Amen.
Let's spend a few minutes.